Why would I ever be careful? Stars, kid.
I had to anyway, but the timing.
I wonder how many, what percentage of our recordings have you tried to disguise a burp?
I thought I'd just get it out of the way.
All right, well, it's staying in. It's staying in. It going out is staying in. It getting out is staying in. You may begin when ready. You gotta do the intro.
Good morning and welcome back to Excerpts from the ABBA Archives, the podcast that's not about ABBA, it's about us. My name is A. Kirby, and with me as always is...
B. Peterson. So much has happened since we last recorded. We last recorded when we were on our way back from the Oregon coast. So much has happened. Like a ridiculous amount of stuff. Yeah. We have our calendar I can look at right now. Yeah. Let's start off with Hannah Gadsby's gender agenda.
Yes.
Strange little guy. What did you think of it, strange little guy?
I really liked it. Yeah. A really fun watch. Real good energy.
Mm-hmm.
Nice to see a bunch of queer people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they're all just there, and they're just chilling. It is a series of comics doing comedy about being trans non-binary, which I think is, like, there's obviously, they don't have to do comedy about being trans non-binary, but, like, it's the whole point of the show, is, I don't know. Like, I think it would be great if they did that same show, but all the material wasn't about being trans non-binary.
For sure.
Anyway. And not all of them were exclusively about it. Like, I really liked the one who's... Were they from Portland?
I forget where people are from.
Yeah. Anyway, the one about, like, I'm like... identify as stupid or like I'm getting stupid anyway yeah. Anyway, they were all really lovely.
Yeah,
they're the it was hosted by Hannah Gadsby, obviously. Have you seen any of there's have we seen Annette or Douglas together?
I've seen portions. I don't think I've sat down to one, but I've gotten a bunch of clips that I really liked.
Yeah, because I really like Hannah Gadsby, and it really has been very much an arc for them, because it starts out with Hannah Gadsby, Nanette, as this feminist tirade, you know? And I was watching Douglas with my friend a couple years ago now. And when it first came out in 2020, I had been like, wow, this is, you know, super progressive and all that. And then I watched Douglas again and I was like, you know, this is very gender essentialist. Like, it's very, like, binary thinking. There were a couple jokes in there about, like, well, you think you have it hard, said the non-binaries, like, very, like ally jokes, but, like, it's still very much, you know, man-woman dichotomy thing.
One joke I remember from that is, like, is it a patch of Doug or something?
Yes.
With the dog?
Yes. The patch of Douglas! A patch of Douglas! Yeah. Anyway, and then Something Special was fun. I don't really remember that much from it. But anyway, so now Hannah Gadsby is identifying as non-binary, it seems. It seems like they're on T.
Mm-hmm.
And that is very clear because their voice has changed dramatically as someone who knows their voice very well and has listened to it a lot. So that was a little jarring. But anyway, essentially my attitude for the whole show was good for them. Yeah.
And I feel like as someone who's like currently questioning their gender,
yeah,
that I liked hearing a bunch of comedians talk about gender because sure. it felt like options.
Yeah. No, it felt like, there was a whole spectrum of folk there. And it is just nice to hear people talk about the things we're going through. So even though I said up top to like, you know, like it'd be nice if it didn't have to just be about identity, you know, we are people beyond our identities. At the same time, man, it's really nice to hear this not coming from Dave Chappelle.
Yeah.
So it's nice to hear this side, you know, the nice side.
Anyway. The comfortable side.
So that's we did that. It was a lot of packing. We went down to Corvallis and I saw my buddy Jacob for the last time before we moved to Spokane, and he fixed my car again.
So nice.
Yeah. And we went and bought Ticket to Ride India at a game store in town. / Switzerland, so we're gonna get to play that with your mom, who's just come back from India, and play Switzerland, which we've been to Switzerland. And we fixed the car, and we played Quintuple Carcassonne. Ooh, nice. And I did win, unfortunately, but it was really fun. It was just at a certain point, it was just like almost like meditative, just placing. You know, just building this huge thing of...
And I'm not worried about running out of tiles.
Yeah.
Which is nice. It's like, tile I want will
arrive. It'll show up eventually. Yeah. Yeah, so that was nice. It was a very long game, obviously. Mm-hmm. Like, at least an hour and a half. Maybe two. Yeah, just placing tiles while sitting on the floor. Mm-hmm. I bought God Emperor of Dune, dang it. I had to read the quotations to Jacob about worm and wife and all the stuff about the homosexuals, Duncan Idaho's relationship to queerness. That book is wild. It's not the best. It's not terrible, but it is deeply, deeply bizarre, and I can't call it great.
I can respect bizarre.
Yeah,
but it's also
very gender essentialist,
which I kind of hate.
Yeah, no, it's disgusting. And again, it's Stalin God, so it just.
I mean, I do like, I don't know. I do get some pleasure out of like, Duncan Idaho talking about those perversions, and then I'm like, I can make
two women mad. Engaged in a passionate kiss. Oh. Yeah, no, it's weird. It's a deeply strange book, and I kind of want to go through it again just to highlight, like, what is actually being promoted here? I don't know.
Yeah.
And then I just straight up ditched Heretics of Dune. I was, like, in the first chapters, and I'm just like, you know what? This is too far gone. I have lost interest. And I've tried listening to some of the Brian Herbert, Kevin J. Anderson stuff, and I'm like, nope, this writing is not good. And, like, at the very beginning, it's just like, did you know that Vladimir Baron Harkonnen, when he was young, was super ripped and muscled, and it turns out that this weird illness made him obese. And then the reason that Dr. Yue became under his thumb was because Dr. Yue couldn't solve his obesity. And it's just like, it's so much, like, just compounding the problematicness of...
And I'd like hoped, oh, maybe like the more recent books will maybe fix some of those problems.
Nope.
And I just I don't want to touch it. That's
yeah.
so gross.
Yeah. So I am content with, I might read Children of Dune, but I think I'm content with sticking with Dune Messiah. And just as a weird sideshow oddity, God Emperor of Dune. Anyway, we're going to see Dune Part 2 again this week with your mom now that she's back. She really wants to see it because she's a fan of the Dune books.
And she's read all six.
Yeah.
Though probably a while ago.
Oh, a decent time ago.
Yeah, and I'm excited to see it after finishing the book.
Yeah, yeah. It's because now that you've finished the book, because we finished the book, we finished listening to Dune Part 2. We finished it during a surprise trip to Spokane. We surprised my family by bringing up a carload of our stuff that's actually going to be staying in Spokane so we can free up the car to bring stuff to Le Grand and not worry about fitting everything, because we weren't going to be able to fit everything, especially including animal carriers and art and stuff like that. Yeah. So now the stress is gone.
And it was so fun.
Yeah, it was so great. It was so great to, because you were working and you had to work the next morning. Yeah.
I love the energy of like, of course they would never suspect me of doing something this dramatic and slightly stupid.
Yeah. Bold of you to assume I wouldn't drive 12 hours just to drop off some stuff and go, surprise! No, that's exactly what I would do.
Yeah. It's the perfect cover. Yeah,
so you went to work. We were, you got back from work. We were out the door by 11 a.m. Mm-hmm. We got there at 4:30. Surprised my family, dropped off all our stuff. We had a lovely dinner. We chatted with my folks. And then we drove back.
Yeah.
We got home around 12:30 in the morning.
Yeah. You did great.
Yeah. I took my first 5-hour energy in 7.5 years since the day I almost died on a glacier. And then I got injured on the way down and I was alone, on a mountain. My entire hiking company had abandoned me at age 14.
Oh no.
They were all college kids. They were stupid. It's fine. It was one of the best days of my life. Like, I loved that day, but I did almost die that day and it was pretty miserable. In the latter half, the sun was going down. I'm alone on a mountain trying to get off and I'm injured and I'm like, well, this is what the 5-hour energy is for. Gotta run before the sun goes down and the bears come out.
Oh, well, I'm glad you're alive.
Yeah, me too. Anyway, yeah. It's not quite as dramatic as all that, but to a 14-year-old, it does feel that way. Speaking of that day, I was listening to a John Grisham book audiobook that day, and I'm doing that now. Again, I'm listening to John Grisham again, specifically his Theodore Boone series. I'm just plowing through it because it was a childhood series of mine that I really liked. And I'm reading it again, and it's pretty good kids' books. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely YA stuff, but it's fun. It's a fun, quick read, and it kept me awake on the drive back.
Which was great.
Yeah. Let's see here. Yeah, so we did the surprise Spokane trip. Nancy's back. And brought a gift for us, but we'll get to that in a minute. I was thinking it was going to be Ticket to Ride India. I was right and I was wrong in my prediction, but we'll get to that. Darby O'Gill.
Yes.
St. Paddy's Day happened. Tell me about Darby O'Gill.
All right. So Darby O'Gill was a movie that we had on VHS when I was a kid. And it was very, like, one of those strange childhood movies that, like, I watch because, like, you know, my parents would show me movies from when they were kids.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, no one else knew about it kind of thing. And sure. So it was just kind of this weird VHS that we had, you know, that I kind of remember bits of from when I was a kid and then had, you know, rewatched years later. And I somehow got you to agree to watch it with me for St. Patrick's Day.
It was it's a tradition thing for you. I was going to indulge you once.
Yeah.
You know, it's this Sean Connery Ireland movie from the 60s. Like, or if not 50s.
I think 59.
Yeah. So, like, sure, I'll watch it one. It'll be insufferable. I'll make it through. It's only 90 minutes. And then I can say that I've done it.
And it's such like an oddity that I was like, you know, oh, this will be an interesting one to watch.
At the very least, it'll be bizarre, right?
Yeah.
And it turns out that it is, you know, moderately bizarre. It's also quite good.
Yeah.
It's an enjoyable watch. I'm not going to call it great or nothing, but I had a really good time.
Good.
You know, an Irish, it's the town drunk essentially. You know, the one who's always telling the tall tales of the leprechauns and this, and everyone kind of indulges him because he's sweet and harmless. And then it turns out that he's right. Is he? I mean, part of the thing is, like, it's a very small aspect of the film. Is like, can we trust him? Because no one else sees, you know, the leprechauns or whatever. Because they're hiding, you know, they have their charms and they can look like a rabbit or whatever. Anyway, and it's just a very sweet story about a man who's wanting to maintain a good life for his daughter and him. And there's some weird heteronormative stuff or whatever. At the same time, it's Sean Connery singing, and so I don't really care. And also, the young Irish girl is very pretty, and I'm just like, oh yeah, no, that would be nice to be that, you know. I'd like to be, you know, nice little Irish girl, pretty Irish girl. But I'd rather not randomly die? What? And there's a banshee? And the third act of this film comes out of nowhere? And gets very dark very quickly. No, it's a strange watch, but I got swept up in it. And it's, you know, it's got the magic little leprechauns with some very good visual effects that we watched a behind the scenes explainer video for how the VFX were done.
So cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Man, they're between this and Dune. Like, yeah.
That forced perspective, like,
yeah.
So impressive.
Yeah, so I'm charmed. I'd watch it again. Yeah. Cool.
Oh, well, I'm glad. Yeah, and I really
So as someone who's seen it many times, now watching it through my eyes, what did you see?
I like that it's a kid's movie.
Mm-hmm.
That's about, to some extent, an old man dealing with age.
Yeah.
And dealing with, you know, kind of being swept aside and not taken seriously anymore.
Mm-hmm. It's about a community that values every member,
mm-hmm.
even if they're not, necessarily adding value in the economic sense.
Yeah.
Like, they're very easily dismissible, and yet the whole town... He's a nice guy. We like him.
Yeah, we don't want to...
We value that.
Yeah.
And the people who don't are jerks, and they're going to get their comeuppance.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, and I like... You know, he has this relationship with the King of the Leprechauns.
Mm-hmm.
And I really... It's just so wholesome.
It's pretty wholesome.
That he's just Leprechaun King and, like, old man.
And they're just... And they're scamps. They're weasels. They're trying to outsmart each other or whatever and threaten each other with murder. But it's cute.
Yeah.
I'll stick a cat on you. And he's, like, holding the cat. Like, ah! And then it's like, no, no! So, yeah.
And I think... Like, the main interaction that they have is, like, the reason for it is that he's been, Darby has been telling the stories of the leprechauns and, like respecting them and...
Yeah, telling people how to be courteous towards the leprechauns.
And no one believes him, but he's trying.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he is having a hard time and is maybe getting kicked out of his house, the King of the Leprechauns says, oh, well,
You get sanctuary.
Yeah, you got kicked out, you're getting kicked out of your house, well, come live with us, you know, I'm gonna spirit you off. And protect you.
But you can't leave.
Yeah, but I like, I don't know, it's very, very wholesome.
Yeah. No, there's no evil there's no, like, evil, dastardly bad guy. There's death, and there's, like, banshee spirit, and there's a jerk and his mom, who's also a jerk, and they're just kind of wanting to have upward mobility in a society that doesn't really allow that. And the film doesn't really comment on that, about how this one guy just owns a town. But anyway. Also, Darby O'Gill and the Little People is the title of the film. Progressive for 1959.
Yeah.
That term may age out and there might be, you know, times change. But for now, Darby O'Gill and the Little People, respectful.
Hmm.
No, it's Delight. The lead, I don't know his name, but the guy who plays the lead actor, I forget the character. What's his name? The main guy?
Michael? Or Darby?
Oh, it's Darby O'Gill. Oh, my stars. Darby is a really talented performer, and he's got a huge presence. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, not your typical lead for Disney Fair. So, no. It was a really good time. And it's from the... I kind of wondered. It turns out it was the same director as Mary Poppins, mm-hmm. who... I've got issues with Mary Poppins, and then there's all the backstory behind Mary Poppins. But, like, as a film, in terms of just, like, solid, like, just placid entertainment, it is just sweet.
Yeah.
Like, and not even, like, in a sickly sense. It's just nice. Mm. And I do respect that. Disney, at its best, is able to do that. Where make just a nice piece of entertainment that is comforting and isn't afraid to rub up against some, you know, danger or stakes or something, but it's just a comfortable place to be.
Yeah.
And I think Disney at its best is able to do that.
And I like...
They're also a soulless corporation that is trying to destroy all art as we know it, but anyway.
Yeah. And I definitely, like, the Disney that I remember... when I was a kid,
mm-hmm.
which was, you know, like when I was a kid, Disney wasn't the corporation that was buying, every property imaginable.
Disney was a series of VHSs for you.
Yeah. And it, you know, they came in.
The 19th Disney, Walt Disney masterpiece.
Yeah.
Maybe not quite that. But
yeah. And I collected them. And like for me, Disney was like Snow White and Pinocchio and mm-hmm. Mary Poppins and like all the like old ones that my parents watched as kids.
Sure.
And those, like, I don't know, those are kind of post-Disney energy, because I feel like there's kind of, like, a self-awareness to a certain extent.
Well, after the Renaissance, yeah.
And I literally like the pre-self-awareness, the kind of just,
mm-hmm.
we're just gonna do the sweet picture.
Yeah.
We're not gonna comment on it, it just is the sweet picture, and I really,
mm-hmm.
I like... I don't know.
I think that's why I like. I think that's why I liked Strange World a lot, which is a recent film of theirs that actually tanked and did horribly. And we found it. We went to Music Millennium one last time. We found a 4K for $7.
Yeah.
For Strange World, which I found to be ridiculous because that's just an unironic adventure picture, and I found it to be really sweet and endearing. And besides a really colorful world, like it's all the stuff that Disney does best. Mm. And plus it has a queer lead, so, like, that's cool.
Yeah, I haven't seen it, but I'm excited too.
What else we got? Went to the Hollywood one last time. Just kind of last minute, saw that there was a showing coming up for Certain Women,
mm-hmm.
which is one of my very favorite films. In honor of Lily Gladstone, I'm guessing that's why it was selected. In honor of Lily Gladstone and all of their awards buzz for Killers of the Flower Moon, mm-hmm. which they didn't win, and that sucks.
Yeah, they deserved it.
yeah, they did.
Yeah, Emma Stone's really... great, but yeah. but they
deserved... I've seen Poor Things. Emma Stone is great. Lily Gladstone deserved it.
Mm.
Emma Stone already has one.
Yeah.
So that was a bummer that they didn't win. That's my only Oscars comment, is that it's that they had... really cool opportunity to give an out non-binary actor a lead acting Oscar, and they didn't.
And an indigenous one.
And also an indigenous actor. Yeah. Yalitza Aparicio was nominated for Roma but didn't win, and now Lily Gladstone was nominated for Killers of the Flower Moon and didn't win. But anyway, Certain Women was playing.
Mm.
But it wasn't just a screening of Certain Women.
No.
What else would you do?
Kelly Reichardt, the director, was there and did a panel of, like answered questions and...
Yeah, did a live discussion and Q&A after the screening of the film. And so we went. We got tickets. It sold out, but we got tickets. And we sat in the front row,
mm-hmm.
and we watched this gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous picture that I love so, so, so much and is very, very close to me. And just, on this huge screen,
And then there was Kelly Reichardt there, and I got to give her a note, and she signed my Blu-rays of all of her films that I have for Old Joy and Showing Up and Certain Women, and we talked for a minute, about a minute after after the screening. And so I got to meet a hero. Yeah. So that was cool. That was really cool.
And we were like the closest ones to her during this.
Oh yeah, we were directly in front of her.
Yeah.
And yeah, like we made eye contact several times. She clearly noticed that I had all my Blu-rays just sitting in my lap as I was gawking at her. Yeah. I was the Uber fan of the night. Mm. But yeah, it was just really, it was special.
And she answered your question.
Yeah, she answered my question about soundscapes. And noise, and it's interesting to me that Kelly Reichardt, who makes very quiet films, finds quiet to be stressful and tense, and noise to be comforting, where I feel the opposite, and it's why I enjoy her films so much, is because they're so quiet and relaxing. Like, I find Certain Women to be relaxing, and I found it a little jarring when the person introduced it about, like, this horror of misogyny, and, like, and microaggressions, and yeah, it's all in there, and I get that, but also, I just find the film so relaxing as a place to live in.
Yeah.
It's
slow and it's a lot of just nice shots and just people living their lives.
Yeah, I find that so restful.
Yeah.
In comparison to all the noise of movies that, like, something like Dune Part 2, which is fun, but it stars it loud.
And I think, like, there's horrors of microaggressions, which I really love how this movie portrays them. Mm-hmm. But it's also sympathetic to all its characters.
Yeah. No, there isn't anyone who isn't human, completely human in this film.
Yeah.
Well, except for the animals. The horses and the dogs.
Yeah, they're not completely human.
Yeah, but they're very, still very sweet, yeah. And they're lovable. Anyway.
A little dog run around. So cute.
Yeah, so that was a really cool evening. That was a really cool evening. I love that. Like, it would have been cool if she was, like, you know, had, like, amazing answers to every question and, like, could recall all the specific details of her work. But she's very much like, yeah, like, I worked really hard. I've forgotten every... I had to look up on IMDb about this movie because I'd forgotten it. Like, I made it, but, like... But it was also 8 years ago that she made the film. And she's like, I don't remember this stuff. I don't... Like, you ask what I thought while I was making it. I don't know. And just like, I'm just, and like, not in a mean way, but just like, I forget. And she's just like very kind of rampant, just like a person. She was just a person up there.
Really, really good energy. I liked her a lot.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was my fangirl moment.
I loved seeing you get to meet her and we weren't, you know, we went in and, she had a, you know, this lovely letter written, and the Blu-rays, and, you know, we weren't sure, like, if we were going to get to, you know,
yeah, we had no idea,
or, like, how close we would be, and so I was really glad that you
It worked out perfectly. It worked out perfectly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was lovely.
Yeah. And now we're here, and it's today. And Nancy came by, got to see your mom for the first time in a long time.
Like a month?
A month plus, yeah. Because she'd been in India for a month, and then she still had a week back in the Bay Area with her sister. So yeah, we finally got to see her and Atticus. And we played Dune. We played the board game Dune, and you won.
Yes, and my second time.
And I'm assuming you enjoyed the game a lot more, the three players, than with two.
Yeah, I like being able to watch other people, because I feel like, just in general, like, when it's, like, two players versus more players, it's really, like, directly competitive if it's two of us, but it's, the competition is spread out a little more among three.
I think what we figured out, though, as we were talking afterwards, is I think I've solved how to make Dune fun for you every time, which is that you really liked when we... during the game
we had an Atreides Fremen alliance against the Harkonnens. A big surprise.
Nancy played the Harkonnens. Yeah, doesn't know how to play.
Yeah, but Nancy was also the Harkonnens and easily won the first battle by calling traitor on the first battle, which I guess it turned out was part of your strategy.
Yeah, I wanted to know.
You wanted to know if Jaemys was safe. But you really liked the cooperative aspect of it, of being able to team up with someone. And so figured out that as long as we have three players, that we can just have you on a team with someone else permanently. Mm-hmm. Like, even if you're just playing the one faction, like it could be you and, for example, my mom playing the Fremen, or you and, you know, and Nancy playing the Bene Gesserit or whatever. Like, as long as you're on a team, it could technically function the same way as a two-player game. Like, if we had three people playing, it'd just be I would play two factions and you each would play one faction allied permanently.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, because I really liked, I don't know.
Like, you didn't like how the being mean to each other is kind of built into the game.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's, you. Yeah, it's just not a, it's not a game. It's not a mechanic necessarily, but it's how the game is designed. It is a game of conquest, diplomacy, and betrayal.
And I really like the game. I think it's so cool, but I just like,
but that aspect makes you feel uncomfortable and tense.
Yeah, and I don't, I just like, it's, yeah, I don't enjoy it every time.
So going forward,
I've enjoyed it like almost all the time.
But going forward, we know how to probably ensure that you will enjoy playing it.
Yeah.
As you will be, if you can work with someone the whole time.
Yeah.
So yeah, we played Dune and it was great. And your mom gave us a gift.
Yeah.
I'm gonna let you take it from here.
Yeah. So she'd been saying that she had a gift for us.
And I was worried that it was Ticket to Ride India.
And I was like, well, I think she'll probably get something from India.
Yeah, but I was like, I don't know, it could be. It could be a game. It turns out it was a game.
Yeah. She got us this beautiful chess set made of marble.
A marble chess set. Marble chessboard, marble chess pieces.
Yeah. From the family, like 14th generation of the family that made the Taj Mahal.
The Mahal family, who 14 generations of marble workers. And we know their work is good because the Taj Mahal is still there.
Yeah. And it's a beautiful board. It's marble with the, all these inlaid some precious stones.
Yeah, with these floral designs around the chessboard. And it's translucent marble, so like you could put a light under it and it glows.
And it's weighty.
Oh, it's heavy. It's super. I mean, it's stone. It's a stone chess set.
Yeah. It's so nice. It was such a sweet gift.
It's the most generous gift I think either of us have ever received.
Yeah.
Like, maybe not that we have any idea how much this cost, though it couldn't have been cheap, obviously. But, like, even if it doesn't have the highest, like, price ticket, you know, of any of a gift that we've received, like, we are going to be living with your mom rent free for 2 years.
That's quite a gift as well.
That's a huge gift, but like in terms of like, here's a thing.
Yeah.
Oh my stars. We were at a loss for words.
And like a nice thing just for the purpose of being nice. Cause like I have a chess set that works fine.
Yeah, you can get a chess set for $5 with plastic pieces and a plastic board. I can make it out of Carcassonne pieces and Lego. Like, I was thinking about making a Lego chess set when we got to Spokane and I could dig through my Lego and make you a chess set. It's not going to compare. It's never going to be close to this.
This is pretty great.
This is pretty great.
Yeah.
So, thank you, Nancy.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Yeah.
And now we're going to play a game of it.
Yeah.
Do we have anything else to talk about?
Dune. Because I do have some thoughts
on okay, yeah, you finished story. Dune. So yeah, you talk about Dune.
Okay, so we finished the book. And, yeah, I really liked reading it. I really enjoyed hearing you read it and hearing the audiobook. Just a great read. I think there are a couple things that stood out to me, and I think mainly like my criticisms of it have stood out to me.
Mm-hmm.
Right
after we recorded last time, we got to the bit with Hera. Is that her name?
Yep.
Which is, you killed Jaimus in combat. Here is your wife now. This woman is yours to either serve as servant or wife. And she's like mad that she's not a wife.
And she's, and by the way, like, let's pause for a second. He's 15 years old. She is like a fully adult woman who's had two husbands already and two kids.
Mm-hmm.
And one of her kids is like 10 years old. So she has a 10-year-old child and she wants to be married to a 15-year-old.
So I had not considered that.
I'm just going to say.
And, gross.
And by the way, so, and in the book as well, like, you know, he has a relationship with Chaney and they have a child. Mm-hmm. He's 17, 18 is his, like, the oldest he is in this book.
Yeah.
And he has, like, a kid and is, like, a father.
Yeah.
So that's kind of weird.
Yeah, I mean, every single adaptation has aged him up. You cold?
Yeah.
You cold in your Deadpool onesie?
Yeah.
You have a Deadpool onesie.
I got it in middle school when all my friends were getting onesies.
And it still fits. And I ended up with this one.
Well, it's never really fit because it's too long for me and the crotch goes down to almost my knees. But my
comment was that you're tiny. Speaking of tiny, Kelly Reichardt is tiny. I wish I had gotten a picture of you two side by side. I don't know which one of... I think Kelly Reichardt is a little taller than you, but not much.
Yeah, I saw, like, when I, like, looked back at the video where, like, you're standing next to her, I was like... Because, like, on stage, you can't really tell. Yeah. But then next to you, I was like, oh, wait.
She's tiny. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah, every single adaptation of Dune has aged Paul up. And that is an obvious move to make. Because it's... One, you have to get a 15-year-old actor to do all this stuff. But then you also have a 15-year-old doing all this stuff.
Yeah. And it feels like teen boy fantasy. Like, to a certain extent, where, like, this could appeal to teen boys who are like, hey, I'm 15.
I have a child and a wife. And I must cause a jihad. Wait, what? This is your fantasy, Frank Herbert? Yeah. Okay, so that's one aspect.
Yeah, so that's weird. But the other thing that, like, really stood out to me in terms of, like, this is a... I mean, there's... It's kind of... It's a weird story. It's got a lot of stuff going on. But it is a story with a protagonist. And it's, you know, a sci-fi story with protagonist.
Mm-hmm.
That involves defeating an enemy. So it's kind of got this, your typical hero's journey, your teen boy hero has to gain his powers and, like, and get, do the revenge thing.
Yep. Your teen boy chosen one.
Right.
Has to beat the evil bad guys.
And so pretty typical in that sense.
Now, this is from the 60s, so this is where a lot of this stuff comes from.
True.
Like, Star Wars is ripping off Dune.
Right.
That's but, it.
You know, but it's got, the, you know, these patterns that
mm-hmm.
are recognizable. And, sure. And I mean, are old in the sense of, like, the hero's journey or whatever. Like, you know.
Joseph Campbell stories. Needs to be unpacked, but yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. And I'm not that I know much about the hero's journey, but I have basic, or some limited exposure. But the weird thing is, he doesn't really, he never fails. And this is true of all of the, at least I'm gonna qualify what fails means in this sense, because I don't mean that, like, I don't know, you could argue that he fails morally and that there's, that it's a fall in the end as the mm-hmm. movies interpret, as the new movies interpret it.
Yeah.
But, in terms of strictly, like, his ability to defeat people.
To fight.
His ability to fight and his ability to lead and his and weird supernatural powers.
Yeah.
He doesn't fail. He never...
He is always the best fighter.
He
can see the future.
He's a 15-year-old kid mm-hmm. who's always the best fighter of everyone.
Mm-hmm. And it's unquestioned.
He could beat the best of the Fremen.
Yeah.
The Fremen. mm-hmm. who are better than the Sardaukar, you know, like,
yeah. He's just always the smartest person in the room.
Yeah. And additionally, they always cite, oh, he was trained by Gurney Halleck and Thuvur Howat, who are like the best people ever, you know, Duncan Idaho.
Sure. Best swordmaster in the universe.
And so essentially it's like him, this is a story where he and his friends are the strongest people in the universe, and that's why people are after them. Like, that's why the Emperor wants them, is because mm-hmm. the Atreides were getting too strong.
Yeah.
And so the cause for the tension, initial tension in the story is, wow, the hero was just too cool and strong. And then in the story, the mm-hmm. hero is always the coolest, strongest person, and all of his friends are as well. And it feels so weird. And I would argue, like,
there's no complexity there.
There's no complexity, and there's no believable tension. Like, usually with
a protagonist, he's always just going to win.
Usually with your protagonist, to gain sympathy, you need them to have challenges mm-hmm. so that you want them to win.
Yeah.
And so that you fear for them, you care about them. That is not this story. Like, I think in the first book is the fall. It's when the Atreides are, you know, attacked by the Harkonnens and he gets, you know, kicked out in the desert.
Again, best thing that out of this entire franchise that I've come across is that book one.
And I would argue that the second two books don't hold me because of I'm going to say my issue with the character. Mm-hmm. Like, my issue with these characters means that the first third, where they actually, there is a sense of impending doom,
mm-hmm.
there is something going to struggle happen to them.
Yeah.
That is interesting. But then once they get into the desert, it's very pointed.
There's no stakes.
There's zero stakes. We know he's going to win.
Mm-hmm. The only interesting stuff is, like, the stuff on Gaiety Prime.
Yeah.
And with, like, Hasmir Fenrir, who, by the way, Hasmir Fenrir in a last-minute twist, and I say last-minute, could have been a Kwisak Haderach had he not been a eunuch and his energies were pointed in the wrong direction. And, like, what, Herbert?
There's so much, like, bio-essentialism.
Mm-hmm.
Like, bio-essentialism.
Frank Herbert is investigating, these are eugenicists. These are eugenicists.
Yeah.
But and Leto is, like, all about it. And
specifically with gender.
Leto the second, I mean.
Yeah.
Does Frank Herbert believe that DNA holds the power, the key to superpowers? Or is this a what if scenario? Or, like, what is he getting at? I don't know what he's getting at. Because, like, it's a fun world, but there's some gross stuff at the base of it. If it's not called out and deconstructed.
Yeah.
And we haven't really seen a version that deconstructs it. I think the closest that I've seen is Dune Part 2, mm-hmm. which takes that thing about Paul failing and it becomes about his failing.
And the that story is addresses it.
And by making Chaney co-lead, mm-hmm. it is about this, I mean, he says it is like, we need to offer them hope. And he's like, it's not hope. It's just self-fulfilling prophecy. This sucks. I don't want to do it. And then he does it. And that's bad.
And I feel like that with the book that, you know, you could read it as this is his fall and that he, you know, has a moral failing at the end. And
But where that interiority was so crucial in the first book, now it's like trying to give sympathy to this dictator.
Yeah, and
as opposed to us just watching him do it and seeing it through the eyes of others.
And no one in the story calls him out.
No.
The narrative
Jessica isn't too keen on it. And in the second book, she completely denounces him and wants nothing to do with all of it, which is not the way that the Villeneuve version goes. They 180 Jessica.
Yeah.
But she's like, oh, shoot, I've unleashed something that I didn't want. But I think we can agree that the best part of the Dune book, like, even it's better than, I would say, Dune book one, the first third, is baby Aaliyah.
Yes. Oh, it's, yeah.
This little baby just, like, swinging her feet while sitting on the steps and being like, and just All of her dialogue is bananas, and it's so cute and terrifying, and we were robbed of it in the Villeneuve version. We do get it in the miniseries, we do get it in the Lynch version, and it's the best part. It is delightful, and we were robbed of it in the Villeneuve version. I wanted a CGI baby in the Villeneuve version just going like, I don't know.
And the when the Emperor is forced to have like a respectful stern conversation
with a two-year-old.
And he's like, now listen here, child. And
I don't have to do what you say.
And he's kind of like, yep.
You're not my Emperor. Hello, grandfather. Taste the prick of the Atreides Gom Jamar.
And all I'm hearing is the child murderer. It's a meme.
Yeah. I hate child murderers. Here comes one now.
I'm going to get you. It's just a Leo with the Gom Jamar.
Yeah. No, I... And, oh, and there's also the bit of, like, the death of Paul's son, and he's, like, super sad about it, even though he's given exactly zero thought to this child the entire book.
Yeah.
Anyway, so there's just, yeah. It's a mess. It's a mess. The second two-thirds of that book are a mess.
Yeah. And I was also thinking, like, with how, like, the way tension happens and the way, like, the stakes are built, I feel like it often relies on, like, his prescience to determine the stakes. If that makes sense. And because, like, during, like, I'm thinking specifically mm-hmm. of, like, the scene with him and Fade Rotha.
Okay.
There is build up in the sense that, like, both these characters have been built up.
I do like the throne room scene in the book in terms of he doesn't know how, he sees different people that can kill him in different ways.
I do like...
I really like how Thufir goes out.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, I liked that. That was one thing that
I really liked. And again, we were robbed of Stephen Henderson in part two. I like the bit with Fenrir. Mm-hmm. Is just like, kill him. And Fenrir's like, you know what? No. We're eugenics bros. Yeah.
but specifically
with Fade Rotha.
There's a moment where it talks about how Paul... can see in the future how much this moment is a nexus.
Mm-hmm.
And that this moment is so important.
He cannot see beyond it.
Yeah, it's so important he can't see beyond it. And I feel like there are these moments in the book where his prescience tells him this is a really important moment. And it feels like Herbert is saying, now pay attention, everyone.
The
this
stakes
moment's
are high.
Really important, but yeah. Then he doesn't prove it.
Yeah.
And so, like, he doesn't back it up with there being actually, like, Paul losing in any way.
Sure.
And so it's just like, yeah, okay, Herbert, I get it. It's important. Like,
yeah.
What do you want me to do with it?
Yeah. And but... I think that's the film suffers as a result of Fade Rotha not having that little thing in his uniform, mm-hmm. the little prick thing.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause then it just makes, I'm a good fighter. I'm a better fighter than you.
Yeah.
And it's not, I can overcome this cunning.
'Cause I did like that.
Yeah. What I really liked, what jumped out to me from book three, besides Baby Aaliyah, is after he takes the Water of Life and becomes the Kwisatz Haderach, how he just immediately starts talking about all the ships that are above us right now and they're ready to rain hell down on us. That was like, oh, we haven't even been considering space this whole time. Like, it's just been about fighting on the ground, and then we're like, oh.
Look up.
And he sees them all. And that is a very frightening image. Mm-hmm. And I like that. And again, it goes to, this is something I think that is weak on Villeneuve's adaptation's part, is the lack of the presence of the guild.
Because
mm-hmm. I really like the guild in the throne room scene as well.
Yeah.
And how they're keeping everybody in check because, yeah, with their weird priorities.
And I like...
Like these weird little gremlins on the side just being like, actually.
And I think they show the importance of the spice both in the sense of like it being addictive and what it can do in terms of space travel.
Yeah, in terms of an economic factor.
And I really like their presence there because of that.
Yeah, and it's essentially absent in the film.
Mm.
Yeah, so anyway. Yeah, mixed bag.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess my other thought was that it felt like there's a lot of ideas in the story, mm-hmm. but it mentions them, and like they don't feel like embedded in the story. If this like because I feel like the story, like just the basic story, is very like point A to point B. Mm-hmm. Paul becomes the Kwisatz Haderach,
and then it jumps over all of these bigger and bigger hurdles each time with ease. Yeah, because he is the chosen one.
Yeah, and I feel like that is like the Paul storyline feels is like, I don't know, the central thing. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty simple. He just does the thing. But there are all of these interesting political aspects that are brought up, like the religion as colonialism. And like anti-colonialism and
it's there. It's not really explored in the book.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. Is that like it
that's what I really like about the Villeneuve version. It brings that out.
Yeah, because the book like has these really interesting ideas and this really interesting world building, but it's telling a story about a guy who just goes from point A to point B. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like I don't know, like it could have done something. I don't know, I want to know that it knows what it's talking about, because mm-hmm. it's mentioning all these things, but then
it's not engaging with
them. It's not engaging. It's just like dropping them and then like
I'm thinking.
And it stacks the deck so much, like on like how cool Paul is and like how mm-hmm. the jihad must happen, and it just like stacks the deck for its favorite character Paul. Who it loves so much, or what, you know, and then doesn't engage with all these interesting ideas.
Yeah.
So it just, I don't know, it feels like a weird read.
What did you think about the very, very ending of the book? Which is Chaney being reassured that this marriage is going to be in name only, and that Jessica saying that history will see us concubines, they will address us as wives. Do you like the movie better?
The movie is so much better. Like
with that respect?
Yeah, like it gives Chaney like just basic agency, like mm-hmm. this is, you know, someone who's been hurt.
Yeah.
And I don't know, cuz I feel like,
and it can't just be waved away with a two sentence affirmation.
Yeah, like yeah. I just felt like it took all the agency away from Chaney to mm-hmm. just have her be cool with whatever.
Yeah.
I really
like that ending.
It's such an improvement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because otherwise it feels like, and like even if, like, because I think you mentioned that Herbert wrote Dune Messiah as like a response to the idea that Paul was
cool.
Was cool.
Did he not read his own work?
Yeah.
It seemed like he was trying really hard to make Paul seem cool.
Yeah, but if Paul wasn't cool, then like why does Chaney accept him?
He's charismatic. Like he keeps going back in Frank Herbert stuff that we must be wary of charismatic leaders. Not necessarily great ones, but charismatic ones. Yeah. I think that's what he's trying to get at, is like he was worried about Kennedy. He was worried about Kennedy, and he was I think this is kind of a key to the thing, is that he was really grateful for Richard Nixon for showing America not to trust its leaders. Now, yes, but also we had to have Richard Nixon, and in God Emperor of Dune, there is a line, which is, what better way to show the dangers of a tyrant than by example? And I feel like there is a better way.
Yeah.
We could also just not have tyrants and just know that they're bad.
Which is interesting, because also in Dune, the Harkonnen's whole Baron Harkonnen's whole plan is, we're going to show the people a tyrant in
Rabban, and then give them Fade Ralpha, and they'll be happy under their subservience.
Yeah, so that, you know, by that logic, they would be even more suspicious of Fade Ralpha, you know,
or the Harkonnens are doing the right thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it's, yeah, it's weird.
But he's gay.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, I can just keep talking about Dune, can't I?
And
I
much to unpack.
Yeah, I like the book version. In certain ways, I like the book version more than Villeneuve's adaptation because it has a lot more flavor and detail than the film does. The film is very stark, brutalistic, very clear and obvious. That said, it engages with its ideas more than I think than the book does.
I feel
and
like
so I feel like I would rather spend time with the Villeneuve talking about the Villeneuve's politics than the book's politics, because I think the book's politics are uglier.
Yeah, and I feel like at least I don't know, and maybe
and
maybe
also it's there's it's you know, obvious. Maybe it's because it's 60 years later and just sensibilities.
Yeah, but I don't know. I feel like the movie knows what it's talking about. I don't know. Not to say that the book doesn't, but the movie feels like a well-structured essay, and you know, and I like a good logical essay that where it has
and all maybe it's points. A high school essay.
Maybe, but it is an essay where I can see there's the thesis where it should be, where I know what the thesis is, I know what we're talking about, and it never loses me. I know,
and it holds true to that.
I know what the argument is the entire paper, and I can say yes, that is an argument. Whereas with the book Dune, I'm like, I think I know what there's. Some
I don't.
Arguments.
What are you getting at?
Where's your thesis? It's just like rambling on about some stuff, and I'm like, oh, that was a good point. That's not related to your argument, but on a side note, that's a good point.
And then you contradict it later with this.
And it's like you're saying some good things, but I can't tell if it's by accident or not. Mm-hmm. So I don't know.
Yeah. I'm eager to read Messiah to You.
Yeah.
And which is a mercifully shorter book. Dune is long. It is a very long book. All right. Let's play chess. Your move. The first move on our fancy marble chess set. Mm-hmm. And of course, you advance your pawn 2 in front of your queen.
Yeah.
Because what else are you going to do?
Now we're going to have to get back into playing chess.
Yeah.
Good use of the gift.
Yeah. So we have tomorrow, we are selling your comics.
Yes.
Tomorrow we are going to Taqueria Puñales. And tomorrow we are looking at all of your mom's India photos. And Friday, we're seeing Dune Part 2.
I like the design of these pawns. They're cute.
Yeah, they are cute.
They look like little mushrooms.
Yeah, Friday, we see Dune Part 2, and we'll go to Emerald Line afterwards one more time. Saturday, we have Rocky Horror for Virgins. Ooh. We've been to see it before. I wasn't a huge fan of it.
The movie or the showing?
The experience. Yeah. It was very overstimulating.
This will be, it's, you know, that was Night Before Halloween.
Yeah.
And it was the cabaret. So this is going to be much quieter.
Yeah. They're still probably going to be calling out and yelling things at the screen, but we'll actually be able to just watch the movie.
And the calling out is part of the point.
Yeah.
And since we've seen it twice.
Yeah.
My turn.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Check.
Yeah, and I think we'll have one day where nothing's planned.
One day. Sunday, nothing is planned. Our last day of relaxation before Monday, the U-Haul, and the packing, and the cleaning. And Tuesday, we move. Sunday will actually probably be dedicated to printing and making invites.
That'll be fun.
Yeah, that's what we're going to spend Sunday doing. It's because we have our wedding invites for the wedding itself, and also the reception, which is where most people will be going because we're doing a private ceremony. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whose turn is it? Mine?
I went there.
Yeah, you did.
These are very satisfying pieces. I like the rock.
Yeah. I was about to be like, where's my knight? And I was like, oh, it's gone.
Sorry, sweetie.